Now, Jack, let me tell you about several instances that are of some interest, I think, to all Historical Society members concerning the beach club and the ocean. One day, in early December, shortly before Christmas, we were moving a piano from La Sala at the beach club to the marine room. And one of the men in that group said, "Mr. Kellogg, there's a shark out there in the ocean." Well, we all turned our heads to look, and sure enough, there were two fins sticking out of the water, and it was swimming very, very slowly. Another man in the group said, "Mr. Kellogg, the telephone operator is an expert on fishing and fish in the ocean, fish particularly. And may I call her and ask her to come out and tell us what she thinks it is?" The young lady came and said to us that it was a broadbill swordfish. And that was quite unusual because they seldom swim this far north on this particular coast. She said, "Mr. Kellogg, I'd like to go out and get it." And I said, "What? How could you?" She said, "I have a boyfriend who has, and we have a boat, or use your boat, that's on the little lagoon here, and we'll go out and we'll bring it in." And I said, "All right, if you think you can, let's try it." So she called her boyfriend, and within an hour he was out, and they got in the rowboat, and they rowed out to the swordfish, and he was practically gone by the time that they got to him. They tied the rope around him and pulled him in. We had on the beach at that time a very large, tall swing, about 15 feet high of metal, made of metal, and we strung the big swordfish up by its tail, pulling him up with pulleys, and he was tremendous. Well, 10 or 11 feet long, and probably weighing somewhere between 300 and 500 pounds. At first, we didn't know quite what to do with him, but since there was a meat shortage, that included fish, at that time, because of World War II, we decided to take him down to the market in San Diego and see if they would buy him from us and sell it or for meat. So we did, and they gave us a couple of $100 for this great giant swordfish, and we in turn divided it between the young telephone operator and her big boyfriend. End of this story for the moment. The second interesting story about large fish off the beach club in the Pacific Ocean here in La Jolla Shores was one evening the Spindrift Room was filled with diners, the marine room, perhaps 100 or 200 people. Suddenly someone called attention to the ocean, and here, several hundred yards out, was a tremendous sea lion sitting on its haunches. And, of course, we could see him very plainly because the lights on the roof of the marine room are put there to see the waves and whatever objects that they contain, or fish. And he kept advancing towards the marine room. The tide was coming in, and that was what was pushing him in. We didn't quite know why he was there or what he wanted. But after a while, along came a lady with two tiny little dogs, and they saw this tremendous giant, and the little dogs ran up to him, and he gave a tremendous snort and turned his head, and they scuttled for their lives. Well, when they had gone, he still kept coming towards the beach club in the marine room. And he was probably only 100 yards away or less, and the tide was urging him in. And I decided that he was hungry. So I called one of the busboys in the marine room and said, please tell the chef that we would like to get two fish to give to this sea lion, see if he wants them. So the busboy went out to the kitchen. Within a minute or two, he returned without anything. And I said, what's the matter? He said, Mr. Kellogg, the chef says all we have in the way of fish are Colorado trout, and he doesn't think we ought to waste them on a sea lion. I said, thank him for his ideas, and tell him that I have different ones, and I would still like to give the Colorado fish to the sea lion. So out this young man proceeded, and he walked within 20 or 30 paces of the sea lion, which didn't move. He threw the two large Colorado trout to him. The sea lion grabbed them and ate them, turned around and swam away, and we never have heard from him since. End of that story. Here is the third fish story, which again happens to be in the marine room. One summer evening, when everyone was there dining happily, and the waves were beginning to splash against the windows, we saw our head lifeguard, Fritz Ferenson, and one of our little boys who were the lifeguards during his summer days. They were out that evening, and they had a spear in their hand. Suddenly we saw Fritz cast a spear and drag in a very large fish, which later proved to be a sailfish, and it too, like the previous swordfish I spoke about a few moments ago, had been wounded from someone who shot at it while it was swimming in the ocean. Usually these shots come from power boats, not sailboats, and it's too bad that they have to shoot at anything and everything they see. They brought this fish ashore, and it was dead. The next morning, we hung it up on the swings, the iron swings, out on the beach, and I had a call from Carl Hubbs of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. He said, Bill Kellogg, I understand that you've got a sailfish down there that was caught last night, and I want to see it, and I think we can definitely use it because we have never heard of a sailfish swimming this far north in the Pacific Ocean before. I said, certainly, Dr. Hubbs, we'll send it up to your Scripps Institution of Oceanography today, and then you do with it what you wish. He considered the incident so strange and unusual that he sent it down to the Dr. Hubbs informed me that he wanted to send it down, have it mounted, and sent down to the Natural History Museum in Balboa Park. And the last time that I saw it, it was there in the basement and mounted. So we have played a small part in determining how far north a sailfish might go on certain occasions. And end of incident number two. This extraordinary event occurred in the summer of 1960. In May 1941. That's right. Where do I start? This tale relates a bit to adventures of the marine room. After completion in 1941, things went along quite nicely. And we had an inviolate rule that whenever the high tide reached 6 feet, we would put the heavy 4x12 boards outside the windows to protect the glass, which was rather thin then, and we couldn't get any heavier, from breaking. Of course, it spoiled the view of the diners, but nevertheless, we tried to enforce this rule. One time, the sea fooled us. The tide was only 5'9", but a tremendous storm came out from the west and blew towards the marine room. And early in the morning at 7:30, the windows were broken and smashed all to pieces, and the wave came tearing in to this room. Only the maitre d' and a few waitresses came in about that time, and they were lucky to escape being hit by flying glass, which went from the windows on the ocean side all the way across the room, and in one instance was embedded in the opposite wall. On that same occasion, the tables were floating, the chairs were floating, and fish were swimming all over the floor, the dance floor. We even found a baby octopus underneath one chair. It was an amazing and rather frightening occurrence. And this thing happened to me before we were able to get our heavy 3/4-inch plate glass windows from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1946. The waves broke the windows 3 times in all, and each time it required the closing of the marine room for at least 1 week to repair not only damage to furniture but electricity, but to replace practically everything we had there. All right. When the ocean waves broke the windows and the water came rushing in, it was truly a marine room with, as I have said, many fish swimming inside it. Other incidents that are interesting concerning that room, not when the windows broke, but just outside of that, was on one or two evenings when the maitre d' forgot to close the door to the north of the marine room on the beach, again, remind you. The next morning, we found on one occasion a beautiful big pelican proudly surveying the painted walls of fish. On another occasion, there was a baby seal that wandered in, and we found it early in the morning in the middle of the dance floor. That's the end of those two stories, and shall we go to something else? All right, let's go. When F.W. put in the 4 tennis courts, the entrance to the club was immediately alongside of the court which was farthest east, and to say the least, it was not impressive. Consequently, I decided there had to be a new entrance, and I went to my friend Sessions. Wait a minute, what's his name? I went to my friend Milton Sessions, a great landscape architect and the son of that wonderful lady, Kate Sessions, in whose honor one of our large and fine parks in this area is named. He said, "Certainly, Bill, we'll make an entrance that will be very, very beautiful and practical at the same time." And so he did. And it's the same entrance that we have now. After the entrance was established and put in, I decided to talk to my friend Billy Bell in Pasadena, Southern California's greatest golf designer, who had put in such great courses as the Annandale in Pasadena and the Mythic in Alhambra and many others. And he came down here and he said, "Bill, we can fix a nice 9-hole pitch and putt, all grass golf course for you, and it will make everything look exactly like a park." Excuse me just a minute. One of the reasons I wanted this little golf course was the amazing fact that many residents of La Jolla unwittingly dumped their rubbish and trash on what later became the golf course, but what then was just vacant land. When they saw that we were making a park out of the entrance to the club, they of course refrained from doing it, and we had no trouble in urging them and getting them to not dump their rubbish and trash on our property anymore. Billy Bell accomplished what he set out to do, and I am sure that the La Jolla Beach and Tennis Club has one of the finest entrances of any club anywhere. Excuse me again, many people have played this little course and enjoyed it. Among them, our own great golfer. I've forgotten his name. Our own great golfer, Gene Littler, who practiced here on many, many occasions and improved his game. And, of course, is recognized now as one of the greatest golfers of all time. Another thing that I was interested in doing about this time was acquiring Washingtonian palms to go around on either side of the driveway of the entrance all the way around the little lagoon. I found I could purchase some in Leucadia, and I planted some 300 of those palms, which were then about 5 or 6 feet high, and this was in 1941, all around the lake. Today, those same palms have grown to a height of about 70 feet, and we have to trim them every year or two to take away the dead leaves. However, they do add an additional, make the entrance additionally impressive, in my opinion. When we did this, I went to the city fathers of San Diego and said I'd acquired these palms, and I said to them that I would like to buy more if they would agree to plant them in between the street and the sidewalk, property owned by the city, and if they would take care of them after they were planted. They said, "Yes, Mr. Kellogg, we'll be glad to do that." And so I bought 1,000 palms in Leucadia at $1 a piece, and the city, as promised, planted them in the walks along the La Jolla Shore streets, where they can be seen today. Not all of them were Washingtonians, some were date, but they have added to our community, in my opinion, to the beauty of our community. Following the opening of the Marine Room in 1941, it was essential that I acquired enough area for proper parking, because we found the Marine Room to be popular from the very beginning. And so I went to the pioneer developer of the La Jolla Shores area, Ray Clark Rose, the father of our present citizen, prominent citizen, John Rose. He sold me at a very reasonable price a large block of land bounded by Roseland Drive on the south, Spindrift Drive on the west, and Paseo Dorado on the north. It has served ever since as a splendid parking lot for not only the Marine Room, but the Beach Club apartments that are across the street from it on Paseo Dorado. In 1920, my mother, Florence Scripps Kellogg, and my father, Frederick William Kellogg, built a summer cottage at 420 Prospect, immediately opposite the Bishop School. My mother's father, William Armiger Scripps, was born in London, and in a section of that town that was known as Chelsea. Therefore, she named her cottage The Chelsea. In those days, nearly all cottages in La Jolla had a sign indicating the name of the cottage. It was unique and very interesting, and it's too bad that it had to be abandoned, apparently abandoned, as I don't see many anymore. Another interesting thing concerning property in La Jolla was that the development in the shore area was not going along too well, and my father urged my mother, who had money through the Scripps newspapers in her own right, to buy some of the lots, as many lots as she could, between the Beach Club and the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. She didn't like the idea at first, but he finally persuaded her to do so, which was a wonderful thing for both San Diego and for her heirs and beneficiaries. My father died in 1940, and in early 1950, I persuaded my mother to give ocean lots that she owned north of the Beach Club, some of those she had bought at my father's request, to the city of San Diego to establish a park for the general public. This she did in the early 1950s, and it has become a magnificent thing for many people, particularly in the summertime, when they come by the thousands to sit on the lawns, to go swimming in the ocean, and to have a family occasions, family gatherings, playing baseball and other things to their great enjoyment. The park she named Kellogg Park, after my father, her husband, F.W. Kellogg. I, for one, am very proud of both of them for having established it. The beach in front of Kellogg Park, for almost a mile, is known as one of the safest beaches in the San Diego area. It might be interesting to note also that the park encompasses about 7.5 acres of land, which today would be of great value if owned by individuals. My mother was also interested in helping. Everything she sought was worthwhile in this community, beautiful community of La Jolla. She loved it. And she loved to come down here and be near her aunt, Ellen Browning Scripps. She and her sister, Winifred Scripps Ellis of Detroit, Michigan, and my father, Frederick William Kellogg, gave to the St. James Episcopal Church,
what did I call it now?
Gave St. James Episcopal Church the chapel, which is still there, and which is used on many occasions for very small functions. She also gave to the Catholic priest who was in charge of St. Mary's by the Sea, St. Mary's Star of the Sea, sufficient money to purchase the land on which that beautiful church is now located. Incidentally, she was an Episcopalian herself, as I am, as I and my wife are too. In closing this tape of my reminiscences recorded by my good friend Jack Bungay, I must correct a misapprehension and a misapprehension in the mind of many people. My father's name was Kellogg, but he was not related to the Kellogg Cornflake brothers in Battle Creek, Michigan. He was a newspaper man all his life, from carrier boy to publisher. But speaking of Battle Creek, Michigan, he did know the doctors Kellogg, who founded the famous cereal company, and he did teach me to swim when I was a young man of five in their Battle Creek Sanitarium. So long for now. Maybe there'll be another time, and maybe not. Goodbye, anyway.